You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Eternal and Transient Elements, The Cosmic Past of Humanity and the Mystery of Evil, Collected Works, Volume 184, translated by Anna Moyes. This is Lecture 12, given on the 6th of October, 1918. Basing myself on the science, which we must call the science of initiation, I made two remarks yesterday, which I want you to call to mind again, for we need to take them further. In the first place, I said with reference to the mystery on Golgotha, that the most profound truths relating to this mystery on Golgotha must, according to the nature of the matter, be truths that cannot be established by means of sense-perceptible historical evidence. Anyone looking for external historical evidence that the mystery on Golgotha did in fact take place, doing so in the way in which one looks for evidence for other historical facts, will not be able to find it. The mystery on Golgotha is intended to assume a place in humanity where access to its truths is ultimately mediated in a supersensible way. In a way, people are meant to get used to having the most important thing in earthly existence in such a way that they cannot approach it through evidence of the senses, but only in a supersensible way. The second thing I said yesterday was that the kind of understanding given to them as earthly creatures up to the time of their death, note well, literally up to the time of their death, will not take them so far that they might be able to grasp the mystery on Golgotha with the understanding which is their own, an understanding which develops in the world perceived through the senses. I said that it is only after death, post-mortem, when they are in the supersensible world, that human beings develop the understanding, or the powers to develop understanding, for the mystery on Golgotha. Because of this, I said something yesterday which the outside world will inevitably consider to be absurd, wholly paradoxical. I said that even the contemporaries of the Christ were only able to understand the mystery on Golgotha in the second or third century after the event, and only in their other life, and that the things written about the mystery on Golgotha were inspired by those contemporaries, who inspired the actual writers in the second and third centuries from the supersensible world. The seeming contradiction is that the Gospels, which after all are inspired works, as you can see from what I have said entitled Christianity as Mystical Fact, are works to inspire Christianity. The inspired Gospels could only say the truth about Christianity because, as I have also stressed on a number of occasions, they were written not out of inherent original human nature, but with the last remnant of atavistic clairvoyant wisdom concerning the mystery on Golgotha. The things which I have been saying about the way in which human beings relate to the mystery on Golgotha were taken from the science of initiation itself. Having reconnoitred something like this from such supersensible insight, one may well ask, quote, what does such a thing look like when one compares the facts of external historical life with it? Close quote. Today I will therefore begin by taking one particular ecclesiastical writer from the second century, initially more as a question, with the answer coming to us at the end of today's discussions. I might just as well have taken Clement of Alexandria, Origen, or any other ecclesiastical writer, though the whole would then, of course, have to be in a different form. I am taking one who is often mentioned, Tertullian. Referring to him, I would like to pose the question, quote, how does the external progress of Christian life relate to the supersensible facts of which I spoke yesterday, and the most important aspects of which I have recapitulated for you today? Close quote. Tertullian is a most unusual figure. hearing the things usually said about him, one does not gain more than essentially the knowledge that it is said to have been Tertullian who justified belief in the Christ Spirit, in the sacrificial death, in the resurrection, by saying, Credo quia absurdum est, I believe exactly because it is absurd, because it goes against common sense. Those words actually are not to be found anywhere in his works, nor are they to be found in the writings of any of the other church fathers. They are pure invention, but it is through them that the view taken of Tertullian to this day is often made into dogma. Yet, if one takes the actual Tertullian, no need to become an adherent, the more one comes to the man himself, the more one does develop respect for this strange man. Above all, one feels respect for the way in which Tertullian managed the Latin language, a language which reflects the most abstract way of human thinking, and had already in his day become a language used by other writers to reflect utterly prosaic Roman culture. Tertullian used the language with a real spirit of fire. He brought temperament, mobility, sentience, and a sacred passion into his way of putting things. He was a typical Roman who put things in an abstract way, like any Roman when it comes to the things one often says are real. People of that time with Greek education would not even have considered him to be a particularly erudite person. But he wrote with great intensity, with inner strength. He wrote in such a way that using the abstract language of Rome, he actually became the creator of the Christian way of speaking. The way he spoke, this Tertullian, is indeed intense. In a kind of protective declaration for the Christians, he did, we may say, put things in such a way that the effect of the written word was like hearing it said in words directly by someone in the throes of a sacred passion. There are passages where Tertullian becomes the defender of the accused Christians, who would, during a procedure which was very much like torture, not deny but confess that they were Christians, and said what they believed in. Tertullian wrote, quote, "Everywhere else those under torture are accused of denying the truth. It is done the other way round with the Christians. They are declared to be mentally deranged when they confess what lives in their souls. The torture is not meant to force them to tell the truth, which alone would make sense. The aim is to force them to say things that are untrue, but in fact they are telling the truth. And when they confess the truth from their hearts, they are said to be evildoers." Close quote. In short, Tertullian was someone who had a real sense for absurdity in life. He was someone who had grown together with such Christian awareness and Christian wisdom as had developed a sensitive observer of life. It does, therefore, mean something when he writes, quote, "You have sayings. You do very often in life say from immediate sentience, in God's hands, God willing, and so forth. And that is Christian faith. The soul professes itself, when it expresses itself as a Christian, doing so unconsciously." Close quote. Tertullian was also an independent spirit, someone who told the Romans, being a Roman himself, quote, "Look at the God of the Christians, and consider if the things you give to the world as Romans are truly religious, or if the things which the Christians want reflect true religiosity. You bring war, trouble, and strife into the world, and this is exactly what the Christians do not want to do. The things that are sacred to you are blasphemous, for they are victory signs, and victory signs are not something sacred, but signs for the desecration of sacred places." Close quote. This is what Tertullian said to his Romans. He had a sense of independence, and seeing the things that went on in Rome, he said, quote, "Is one praying when one looks up quite naturally to heaven, or when one turns one's eyes to the capital?" Close quote. Tertullian certainly was not someone who was wholly given up to abstract Roman civilization, for he was deeply conscious of the supersensible, the spirit, being present in the world. Someone who is on the one hand, speaking so independently and freely, and at the same time so much out of the supersensible as Tertullian did, had to be sought out even in those past times, when the supersensible was still closer to human beings than it would be later. Tertullian did not only say in a rationalistic way, quote, "The Christians tell the truth. You declare them to be evildoers, when in fact we should only call those people evildoers who do not tell the truth under torture." Close quote. This was certainly rationalistic, but it was also courageous. And Tertullian said other things as well. He said, for instance, quote, "If you Romans take a real look at your gods, who are demons, and genuinely ask them, you will learn the truth. But you do not want to learn the truth from the demons. If one brings someone possessed by a demon face to face with a Christian and lets the Christian ask him the right questions, the demon will show itself to be a demon. And it will be afraid, but will say of the God whom the Christians acknowledge, that is the God who now has a rightful place in the world." Close quote. Tertullian referred to the evidence not only of the Christians but also that of the demons, by saying that the demons will also profess themselves demons if we merely ask them, doing so fearlessly, and that they acknowledge Christ Jesus as the true Christ Jesus, as it also says in the Gospels. It was at any rate a strange character who faced the Romans as a Roman in the second century. He attracts our attention when we note his attitude to the mystery on Golgotha. He spoke about the mystery in about the following words, quote, "The Son of God has been crucified. We do not feel shame, because it is ignominious. The Son of God has died. It is utterly believable, because it is inept." Close quote. The actual words are, I'll give it my best shot here, "Prosus credibile est, quia ineptum est." It is credible, wholly credible, because it is inept. So he said that the Son of God, oh, and there's a close quote in there if I missed it, okay? So he said that the Son of God had died. It was utterly believable, because it was inept. And he had been buried, had risen from the grave, and that was certain, because it was impossible. The words "prosus credibile est, quia ineptum est" became the other untrue statement, "credo quia absurdum est." We must rightly understand the words Tertullian said about the mystery on Golgotha. He said, quote, "The Son of God has been crucified. When, as human beings, we consider this crucifixion, we do not feel shame because it is ignominious." Close quote. What did he mean? He meant that the best thing to happen on earth must be ignominious, because it is human nature to do things that are ignominious and not those that are outstandingly good. If something were to be presented as a good deed, so said Tertullian, the best deed to be done by human beings, it could not be the most outstanding for events on earth. The most outstanding deed for events on earth will, no doubt, be the one which brings disgrace on man and does not mean glory. This was what he meant. To go on, the Son of God died. This was wholly believable because it was inept. The Son of God died. It was wholly believable because common sense finds it inept, senseless. If common sense were to consider it intelligent, it would not be believable. For things human sense finds intelligent cannot be the most sublime, cannot be the most sublime on earth. For human sense is not at a level in its intelligence where it comes to the most sublime. It comes to the most sublime when it grows inept. He was buried, rose again. This was certain because it was impossible. It is impossible as a natural phenomenon that the dead rise again. But it was Tertullian's view that the mystery on Golgotha had nothing to do with natural phenomena. If one had to refer to something as a natural phenomenon, it would not be the most valuable thing on earth. The most valuable thing on earth must not be a natural phenomenon, which means that it had to be impossible in the sphere of natural phenomena. It was exactly because of this that he was buried and rose again, and it was certain, because it was impossible. In the first place, I want Tertullian to stand before us as a question, especially in the words I have quoted, which are taken from his De Carne Christi. I have tried to characterize him, firstly, as an independent, free spirit, secondly, as a spirit who also saw the demonic and supersensible in man's immediate surroundings. At the same time, I quoted three sentences he wrote, and because of which all intelligent people must really consider Tertullian to have been a nincompoop. It really is always a strange thing with matters of this kind, that people are biased in their judgment. In also producing the wrong notion, such as credo qui absurdum est, they are sitting in judgment on a whole human being. It is important, however, to consider the three sentences which do not make immediate sense. Tertullian certainly also did not want to make immediate sense. Together, firstly with the independent spirit of Tertullian, and then with his complete awareness of the supersensible world being involved in our human environment. Let us now consider something which can cast light on the mystery on Golgotha from a different angle, as it were. These are two phenomena in human life to which I did already refer the day before yesterday. One is death, the other heredity. Death is connected with the end of life, heredity with birth. With regard to death and heredity, it is important that we have a clear understanding when it comes to human life and human knowledge. Considering everything I have been telling you for weeks now, you can see that when human beings use their senses to consider their environment and want to use their intellect to understand the world perceived through the senses, the phenomena of heredity also present themselves with the characteristics of the ancestors popping up in their descendants, in a sense, and people acting out of the subconscious aspect of these inherited powers. We are often studying all these different inherited traits connected with the mystery of birth, even without thinking of them directly. When we study ethnology, for instance, we always speak of inherited traits without being aware of doing so. One cannot really study an ethnic group without seeing everything really in terms of inherited traits. Speaking of any nation, Russians, English people, Germans, and so on, you speak of characteristics which belong in the sphere of heredity, traits which the son has from his father from his grandfather, and so on. The field of heredity, which is connected with the mystery of birth, is vast indeed. And speaking of the external life into which the human being is placed, we often speak of the facts, the powers of heredity, without always being aware of doing so. The mystery of death enters into the life we live in the senses, a fact which is frequently apparent to us, so we need not waste words on this. However, something else emerges when we look back into human powers of insight. We find that our human powers of insight can grasp much in the natural order, but this human power of insight declares itself to be sovereign, wanting to grasp everything to be found in this natural order. Yet this human power of insight will never serve to grasp the fact of heredity, which is connected with the mystery of birth, nor the fact of death. Then the strange phenomenon arises in human life where the whole of human understanding is filled with the wrong concepts. This is because we consider phenomena to be part of the world perceived through the senses, which makes themselves known in that world but are by nature utterly spiritual. We consider human death. It is a bit different for the death of animals and of plants, as I said the day before yesterday, to be a phenomenon in the world perceived through the senses, because that is what appears to be the case. This does not help us, however, to learn about human death. No natural science could ever say anything about human death. All we achieve with it is that we transform our wholly human view into a pseudo-view, mixing the facts of death into everything. We only learn the truth about nature if we leave death aside and leave the hereditary traits aside. The peculiar thing about human insight is that it is ruined, if I may put it like this, and made into a pseudo-image, because people think it could cover everything in the world perceived through the senses, including death and birth. And as death and birth are mixed into the view taken of nature, human perception ruins all views on the world that are perceived through the senses. One will never gain a view of the human being as a creature perceptible through the senses if one includes the qualities of heredity, which are, of course, connected with birth in the sense-perceptible world. One ruins the whole image of man for oneself. I have spoken of three streams, the straight line, normal evolution, the lateral luciferic, and the lateral Ahrimanic stream. The whole of human evolution, which proceeds in a straight line, if one counts birth and death as part of essential human nature, insofar as man belongs to the sense-perceptible world. That is the strange situation when it comes to human powers of perception. Guided by nature herself, these powers are driven to think the wrong things. For if they were actually able to think, an image would emerge from nature, in which there was no heredity and no death in human life. One would need to abstract from death and heredity. One would also have to think nothing of death and birth, and develop an image which does not include them. This would give us an image of nature. There is no room for inherited traits and for death in the Goethean philosophy of life. They do not fit into it. That is the peculiar thing, especially with the Goethean philosophy of life. You cannot do anything with death and heredity in it. This is what makes it so good, and because of this we can take it to be a true nature image, which is real, for there is no room in it for death and heredity. Up to the time of the mystery on Golgotha, people did, on a certain spiritual basis, still think in a more natural way about death and heredity. The Semitic population considered inherited traits to be due to the continuing direct influence of the god Yahweh. One needs to know this to understand the Yahweh point of view. It put anything relating to heredity, at least in places where the Yahweh view was still well understood, outside of mere nature, and saw in it a continued direct influence of Yahweh. The God of Abraham, of Isaac, of Jacob, that was nothing but the inherited traits continuing. And in Greek philosophy, people sought to grasp something in human nature, though decadence meant that it was with little success, which lives in man also between birth and death, but has nothing to do with death. They sought to pick something out from the sum of phenomena where death cannot interfere. The Greeks had a certain fear of understanding death. Their philosophy focused on the sense-perceptible, and so they did not want to understand death, instinctively feeling that if one focuses purely on the world perceived through the senses, as Goethe also did, death is an alien element. Death has no place in the sense-perceptible world. It is alien to it. Then other views evolved from this, and it was particularly characteristic of the nations and people which were in the lead at the time when the mystery on Golgotha was approaching, that certain old views began to change. People were progressively losing the ability to look into the spiritual world. They, therefore, came to think, more and more, that birth and death, or heredity and death, were also part of the sense-perceptible world. After all, heredity and death move around in that world, doing so in a truly tangible way. People came to think more and more that heredity and death were part of the sense-perceptible world. This came to be part of the whole human view. Centuries before the mystery on Golgotha, the other view had thus been invaded by belief that heredity and death had something to do with the sense-perceptible world. The result was that something most strange developed. You'll only be able to grasp it if you let the spirit of what I have been saying here in recent days influence you in the right way. The fact of heredity was seen by moving it into the sphere of natural phenomena. People came to see it more and more as a natural phenomenon. Any fact of this kind calls forth its polar opposite when it comes up in life. You simply cannot accept a fact in human life without it calling forth its opposite. Human life proceeds with opposites kept in balance. It is a fundamental condition for all insight gained that one acknowledges that life proceeds in opposites, and the state of balance between opposites must be sought. So what was the consequence of believing that heredity was a natural phenomenon? The consequence was the most dreadful disparagement of the human will, a fact from ancient times which in spiritual science is known as the influence of Luciferic and Ahrimanic spirits, entered into the human will as the opposite evolved, and a fact which people were really looking for in the field of nature was acting so powerfully in the human soul that it drove people to a moral philosophy of life. Heredity was included among natural phenomena and therefore misunderstood, so that the opposite evolved. Belief that the human will had once brought it about that original sin, hereditary sin in German, continues on in the world. The wrong inclusion of heredity among natural phenomena created the fundamental evil that original sin has shifted to the moral field. This meant that human thinking was also ruined, for it did not get to the point of taking up the right belief that the whole idea, the whole way in which people usually see original sin is blasphemy, a terrible blasphemy. A God who purely from ambition permits the things usually told about paradise to happen in paradise, which is what most people think, doing it not because of the intentions described in Occult Science and Outline, his book, but the way it is usually described, really and truly would not be a sublime God. And to ascribe such an ambition to the God is blasphemy. One will only arrive at the reality in this field if one does not consider the inherited traits which pass from ancestors to descendants in moral terms, but sees them in supersensible terms, even though perceptible through the senses, looking to the supersensible without first giving a moral interpretation, and seeing in supersensible light the things one should not, with rabbinical theology, make into a moral interpretation of the world. Rabbinical theology will always intellectually reinterpret the powers of heredity that are spread out through the sense-perceptible world. We should train ourselves to see the spirit in things, and so discover the spirit also in the inherited traits we see in the sense-perceptible world. That is the crux of the matter. My main concern is to have you realize that without this mystery on Golgotha, humanity would at that time have denied the spirit. Having learned to deny the spirit in the hereditary traits, which were evident in the sense-perceptible world, and people would have come more and more to use rabbinical and socialist interpretations instead of taking the spiritual view. Tremendously much depends on it that we know it to be necessary to say, quote, "You'll not comprehend anything in the sense-perceptible world unless you equip yourself to deal with something which is indeed a supersensible stranger in the sense-perceptible world because it has spiritual connections." Close quote. Things connected with heredity must be considered by taking the spiritual, the supersensible view. The intellect, which has made spiritual into something which is sense-perceptible, although it is indeed something supersensible, making it into something moral that is grasped with the intellect, is the spirit which opposes the spirit of the Christ, the spirit of the mystery on Golgotha. So much about heredity and about death. Yes, the Church Fathers themselves were able to establish that among pagans, too, there were many people who were convinced of immortality. But what was that about? Well, in early times, people did realize that death is a supersensible phenomenon, even in the world perceived through the senses. By the time of the mystery on Golgotha, people had ruined their philosophy of life by taking death to be a sense-perceptible phenomenon, and thus spreading the powers of death also through the rest of the sense-perceptible world. Death must be considered a stranger to that world. This alone will make it possible to have a pure science of the natural order. Added to this were the things which some philosophers of antiquity, in decline, thought about immortality. They considered the immortal principle in man, rightly so, for they said to themselves that death is present in the sense-perceptible world. They did, however, say this from a corrupted philosophy of life. For if it had not been corrupted, they would have had to say that death is not present in the sense-perceptible world. It only appears to enter into that world. They gradually came to think of a sense-perceptible world where death had a place. In so doing, one does, however, ruin everything else for oneself. Of course, you also do so if you generally think that death has its place in it. But when they did so from a corrupt philosophy of life, they also had to say something else to themselves, and that was, quote, "We have to turn to something or other which contradicts death, something supersensible which contradicts death." Close quote. In the decline of antiquity, people had a corrupted philosophy as they turned to the impersonal spiritual principle that this immortal spiritual world, which they did actually call something else, was the Luciferic world. What mattered is not what we call things, but what is truly powering in our ideas. And so it was the Luciferic world. Although different words were used, the philosophers of paganism in decline really said nothing else in all their interpretations but, quote, "As souls escaping death, we want to flee to Lucifer, who will take us in, and we shall then be immortal. We die into the realm of Lucifer." Close quote. That was the true meaning. Today we still see the last remnants of the powers at work which reign in human insight from all the preconditions of which I spoke today. What do you really have to say to yourselves if you take the words which I have spoken from initiation science today seriously? You have to say, quote, "There is man's origin and his death, and his end. These two must not be grasped with the intellect we have as human beings, an intellect which is fit for the natural world. One arrives at a wrong view of both the supersensible and the sense-perceptible if one mixes birth and death in with the sense-perceptible. They do not belong there, being strangers to it. One ruins both one's understanding of the spirit and one's understanding of nature." Close quote. And the consequence? One consequence is this, for instance. There is an anthropology in which the origin of man is ascribed to very lowly creatures, doing this in a very natural, scientific, and very clever way. Go through all the anthropologies where the origin of man is said to go back to lowly creatures, which are envisaged as if something which is said to be found among indigenous people had been there at the beginning of the human race. Such notions are a perfectly correct judgment in natural science. But the conclusion to be drawn is the following. It is wrong exactly because it is scientifically correct. Correct in the light of a natural science where birth and death are believed to be part of the sense-perceptible world. Things were not like that at the true origin of man. When Kant and Laplace developed their theory, they did so on the basis of natural science. It seems that no objection can be raised to their theory, but it was exactly because the theory was developed on the basis of natural science that the situation was different. You will arrive at the right knowledge if, for both the origin and the goal of man, and for the origin and goal of the earth, you accept the opposite to be true of what is considered right today in natural science. Anthroposophy will provide the right information about the Earth's origin, the more it is contradictory to what can be said in the natural science, which is considered to be correct today. Anthroposophy does not contradict natural science. It lets it stand, but instead of broadening it beyond its limits, it draws attention to the points where a supersensible view must come in. The more logical anthroposophy is, the more correct is it with regard to the natural order, which is necessary to and inherent in present-day human beings. The more will it not say what was not at the beginning of human and earth existence. And natural science will be less correct about death the more people fantasize on the basis of the ideas it provides. Without the mystery on Golgotha, it would have been the fate of human beings on earth that exactly the most important things would have had to be considered on the basis of a corrupt philosophy of life. For it absolutely did not depend on a human failing, but merely on human evolution. It simply happened, in the course of that evolution, that people came to consider themselves to be this combination of flesh, blood, and bone. An ancient Egyptian would have found it utterly comical if someone had said that the figure going about on two legs, consisting of blood, flesh, and bone, was a human being. But these things do not depend on theoretical reflections. We cannot dream them up, nor dream them away. No, it gradually came to be an accepted thing to consider oneself to be the form which is made of flesh and blood and bone, though in fact one is the image of all the hierarchies. So much error spread about this that, oddly enough, some individuals who came upon the error stumbled into an even greater error. Yes, some did come upon it, but they did so in an Ahrimanic and Luciferic way. That human beings are not the combination of flesh and blood and bone. They would say, quote, "If we are something better than this combination of flesh and blood and bone, let us, above all, despise all flesh and see the human being as something more sublime. Let us then cast aside the sense-perceptible human being." Close quote. Yet, this image made of flesh and blood and bone, together with ether body and astral body, as we see it before us, is a sham. In reality, man is the absolute image of the deity. It is not that we want to see the devil in the world. As I said, that is an error. It is because we want to and should see the God in our own world within us that it is an error to identify with sense-perceptible nature. It is also quite wrong to say to oneself, quote, "Yes, I am a most sublime being, terribly sublime, and there is this inferior, horrid environment." Close quote. That is not how it is, but rather like this. There we have the realms of the higher hierarchies, all the divine spirits. There's a picture. They considered it their divine goal to join forces in creating a form. This form has the outer appearance of the human body. Into this form, which is calumniated, miserably calumniated when people consider it inferior, the spirits of form have placed the human capital I, the present-day soul, which is the baby among the different levels of human existence, as I have often said. So, if there had been no mystery on Golgotha, human beings could only have developed wrong ideas about heredity and about death, and those wrong ideas would have got worse and worse. They do sometimes come up in an atavistic way today. In some socialist bodies, a philosophy of life is promulgated today which is atavistic, in views where death and birth are included among the phenomena of the physical world. As humanity continues to evolve, it would have to happen that the gate to the supersensible world would close for the human being, and anything he found in the physical world of the supersensible, heredity and death, would lead him astray, would be tempters who would come and say, quote, "We are part of the physical world," close quote, when, in fact, they were not. We will only come to the truth if we do not believe in a natural world which pulls the wool over our eyes concerning death and birth. Man's position in the world is that paradoxical. Something had to be implanted in human beings that would maintain the balance and guide them away from the idea that heredity and death were physical phenomena in human life. To do this, something had to be put before them which made it evident that death and heredity are supersensible and not sensible phenomena. The event which showed humanity the truth again about these things had to be beyond the reach of ordinary human powers, for those were getting corrupted and needed a strong nudge in the opposite direction to correct them. That nudge was the mystery on Golgotha. It entered into human evolution as something supersensible, so that people would have the choice of either believing in this supersensible element, in which case you could only gain insight into it in a supersensible way, or accepted the views which would inevitably result if they considered death and inherited traits to belong to the sense-perceptible world. Hence the ingredients of a true view of the mystery on Golgotha are the two borderline facts of the mystery: resurrection, which cannot be thought of without its link to the Immaculate Conception, but not in the way in which the wool is pulled over people's eyes, pretending it as a fact is a fact, but in the supersensible way, and going through death in a supersensible way. These are the two basic facts that must be the boundaries of the life of Christ Jesus. No one understands the resurrection, which is meant to be the concept that is presented as the true concept, instead of the false idea that death belongs to the physical world. No one understands this resurrection unless he also accepts its correlate, immaculate conception, birth as a supersensible fact. People want to understand this, resurrection and immaculate conception, and today's Protestant theologians actually want to grasp this fact in theology, using ordinary human common sense. But that common sense is but a pupil of the sense-perceptible world, of the corrupt view gained through the senses, which has evolved since the mystery on Golgotha. And when they cannot grasp it, they become followers of Harnack or the like, denying resurrection, producing all kinds of phrases about it. As to the Immaculate Conception, they consider this to be altogether something no one who has any sense would talk about. Yet it is closely connected with the mystery on Golgotha that it holds within it the metamorphosis of death, that is, its metamorphosis from a sensible fact into a supersensible fact, and the metamorphosis of heredity, that is, that where the physical world pulls the wool over our eyes about heredity, which is connected with the mystery of birth, birth is transposed into the supersensible with the Immaculate Conception. Whatever may have been said in error or inadequately about these things, humanity's task is not to accept these things without understanding, but to develop the supersensible insights that will let them grasp these things which cannot be grasped by sensible means. When you think of the lecture courses, where I spoke about these things, and particularly also of the lectures on the fifth gospel, you will find a number of ways for understanding these two things, though only by supersensible means. For it is the case that for as long as common sense continues to be a pupil of the senses, which is how it has to seem to people today in their philosophy of life, humankind will not be able to grasp this fact. It is exactly where the most sublime facts in earthly life are such that the mind, being a pupil of life in the senses, cannot grasp them, that they are indeed true. It is not surprising, therefore, that external science is fighting against initiation science, for this is about things which quite naturally, exactly because they do not contradict genuine natural science, must contradict a natural order which originates in a corrupt view of the natural world. Theology, too, has often taken the wrong direction, albeit a different one from that of corrupt naturalism. If you consider what I said yesterday, that human beings can only arrive at the right view of the mystery on Golgotha after death, you will no longer find it incomprehensible, if you think about it, that on dying, going through the gate of death, human beings enter into a world where they can no longer be told the fable that death is part of the physical world. For they then see death from the other side. I have often spoken of this. And they learn more and more to consider death from the other side. This will prepare them more and more to consider the mystery on Golgotha, too, in its true form. We have to say, therefore, if the mystery on Golgotha had not come about, but anything we say in this way can only be grasped supersensibly, humanity would die. There would also be evil in the world. There would be wisdom in the world. But human evolution made people succumb to a corrupt view of the natural world, and so they had to have the wrong idea about death. Wanting to turn to immortality, they therefore turn to Lucifer and succumb to Lucifer exactly because they want to turn to the Spirit. They are like animals if they do not turn to the Spirit, and they succumb to Lucifer if they do turn to the Spirit. To see the world looking ahead, one wants to be immortal in Lucifer. To see it looking back, one interprets the world by changing the element which is supersensible, even as an hereditary trait, into something moral, and thus fabricates the medieval blasphemy of original sin. Genuine devotion to the mystery on Golgotha will save one from all this. It provides the world with a true, supersensibly gained view of birth and death. Such a true view should cure humanity of the wrong, corrupt view. This makes Christ Jesus also the healer, the Savior. Because of this, and because human beings chose the path that led to a corrupt philosophy of life, not because they were good for nothing, but in the course of their evolution, their essential nature, the Christ is also a healer. Truly not only the teacher, but also the physician for humanity. These things have to be considered. But as I said, and I have repeated it again and again, and it needs supersensible insight to see this, when we ask ourselves, quote, what insights would the souls have gained which in the second century inspired an individual such as Tertullian? Close quote. We have to look to the dead, who may have been contemporaries of Christ Jesus, and in the second century inspired such a man as Tertullian. As there was much corruption of insights in the world, some things would, of course, be wrong, obscure, having one touch or another of obscurity. But if we hear the contemporaries of the Christ in Tertullian's words, contemporaries who were dead at the time but inspired the writer, we can understand how he was able to say such things as, quote, the Son of God has been crucified. We do not feel shame because it is ignominious, close quote. People had to arrive at seeing a thing as ignominious because views had become corrupt. The event, which is the meaning of the earth in the highest degree, would show itself to be an ignominious act in human life. The Son of God has died. It is wholly credible because it is inept. Prorsus credibile est quia ineptum est. Being foolish ineptitude for anything which human beings can grasp throughout life using ordinary common sense. It is exactly a true fact in the sense in which I have put it to you today. He was buried and rose again, and this is certain, because it is impossible, because there is no such thing in the corrupt way of looking at nature. If you take Tertullian's words in a supersensible sense, as inspired by contemporaries of the Christ, you had then been dead for a long time, who had then been dead for a long time, you might say to yourself, quote, yes, certainly, Tertullian took it in the way he was able to take it in with the state of soul he was in, close quote. You will, however, be able to sense their inspired origin. Only someone who was so thoroughly in the supersensible with his knowledge that he would speak of the demons as witnesses of the divine, as if they were human witnesses, would, of course, have had access to such an origin. Tertullian wrote that the demons themselves said that they were demons and that they acknowledged the Christ. That was the precondition for Tertullian being able to perceive anything of what was inspired into him. For those who want to be Christians in the wrong sense, this is a most uncomfortable business. Just consider, if even the demons speak the truth and point to the true Christ, those demons might at some point be questioned by a Jesuit. The demons might engage someone of whom the Jesuit says that he is in touch with demons in conversation about the real origin of the Jesuit's Christ. And the demon might then say, quote, "Yours is not the Christ. It is the one of which the others speak who is the Christ." Close quote. You understand the Jesuit's fear of the spiritual world. You understand that it is profoundly upsetting if one fears being exposed to the danger of being disavowed from some corner of the spiritual world. One might then produce Tertullian as one's principal witness and say, quote, "Well, dear Jesuit, the demon itself is saying that yours is the false god," and Tertullian, who you must acknowledge, was a proper church father, says that it is the very demons which speak the truth about themselves and about the Christ, which is also what it says in the Bible. Close quote. In short, the matter is getting most precarious as soon as it is admitted by the supersensible world, albeit in an unjustifiable form, that demons bear witness to the truth. Even if one were to call on Lucifer, he would not speak untruthfully of the Christ. But it might become evident that something else is untruth concerning the Christ. Initiation truths sometimes sound different from the things which people are comfortable with. This does mean that all kinds of chaos arise when people attempt to introduce initiation truths to the external world today, especially when such initiation truths have to be introduced into the immediate reality. Yes, as soon as the field opens up, where things are made known from the supersensible sphere, conflicts arise, some of them quite extraordinary, if considered in relation to the things that do not well forth from the supersensible. We can often apply this to everyday life. I did feel a certain satisfaction when a suggestion I had made just for myself in my teaching, and things I say in my teaching I say from a personal conviction that is not meant to be binding for anyone, was taken up, and this building was in accord with our experience of the times called the Goetheanum. Even if we include some supersensible impulses, it seems to me to be right and good. If, however, someone demanded that I provided a list of all the reasons, counting them out on my thumb and all other fingers, for something that is felt out of a profound need, all the pros and cons, this would feel like a real sham wisdom to me. One often finds oneself in this situation, particularly when bringing supersensible impulses into play that are meant for the will. People often say, quote, "I don't understand this. I cannot grasp it." Close quote. Well, it doesn't matter so very much whether another person or oneself is able to grasp something. What does grasp mean? It means nothing else but to put the matter in the light where the thoughts are at ease, thoughts which one has comfortably found to suit one for decades. Otherwise, understand, as people call it, does not mean much compared to the truths revealed from the supersensible world. When the supersensible spheres are not just something one is teaching, but are meant to intervene directly in the will, in the sphere of actions, it is always bad if people ask questions intellectually. Quote, why is this or that so? Close quote. Or, quote, how can one understand this and this and this? Close quote. With regard to this, one should get used to seeing certain things of the supersensible world in parallel to things one is continually accepting for facts of the natural world, but only in parallel. I don't know if you go outside and Rover or Wolf or whatever name the dog has bites you, and you had not been bitten before and have now been bitten, do you then ask, quote, why did the dog bite me? Close quote. Or, quote, how can I understand this? Close quote. What connection is there to make sense? You have to let the facts tell you. In the same way, certain supersensible things just have to be told. There are many of them, as you can tell from what I hinted at today, that two seeming things hide their true nature in the sense-perceptible world, human death and birth. They are really bringing something supersensible into the world of the senses. Are strangers to that world, but wear masks, pretending to be part of it, and in doing so also spreading their false mask over the rest of nature. Modern man, therefore, has to see the rest of nature too, in the wrong light. To understand things thoroughly, taking them thoroughly into one's search for insight, this will be asked of man in the future, asked especially by the spirits of the age, of those who want to seek insight for the future and unfold their will in a particular sphere. The demand should apply particularly to the academic fields of theology, medicine, law, philosophy, natural science, technology itself, and social life, and indeed politics. Politics, yes, indeed, truly, even this strange construct. Those who understand the age ought to introduce the knowledge gained through spiritual science into all of these. The end of Lecture 12.